From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. A tree really is the perfect image for illustrating our family history. We all have the obsessed uncle or aunt who sit for hours looking at microfilm or wander cemeteries and then hand out the family trees at Thanksgiving or reunions. But A.J. Jacobs says genealogy and the image of the tree is changing because we're finding more and more connections between ourselves and others. And as he reports in a new book, instead of our own little trees, now you have a forest that people all over the world are contributing to. There's a world family tree that has nearly 120 million people working on it. Today in the program, Jacobs is joining us to talk about his experiment with genealogy, which, of course, included a trip to Salt Lake. Basically, he set out to organize the world's largest family reunion. Join us after the news.
Support for this Radio West podcast comes from Primary Children's Hospital. They're one of 24 children's hospitals in the country that's been recognized by U.S. News and World Reports for providing excellent care in all 10 pediatric specialties. Primary Children's Hospital, the child first and always.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's always something that gets A.J. Jacobs going on an experiment, and a lot of times it's something positive, like, you know, the exciting prospect of learning. But his latest experiment, his exploration into genealogy and family history, came in part because he says he was feeling despair. Despair because we might all be part of this world family, but we're not really getting along very well. And he figured that over time we would have shed our primitive tribalism, but turns out we haven't, not yet. And so part of the question in the book is, the book that he's written, can we ever? This book is his adventure in trying to help build the world family tree. And today in the program, he's joining us to talk about it. It's called It's All Relative, Adventures Up and Down the World's Family Tree. A.J. Jacobs is an experimental journalist, a writer. He's going to be in Utah next week. We'll give you some details about that. He's joining us today from the studios of the Radio Foundation in New York City. And A.J. Jacobs, welcome back. Thanks very much for being with us again.
Oh, thanks, Doug. Great to be back.
Well, let's I guess I wanted to start with what it is about your you mention in the book, sort of whimsically in the introduction, that lately you've been thinking a lot about your 8,000th great-grandparents, but you really have been reflecting on this in a serious way. What got you started thinking about family? When did you start thinking about family in a serious way?
Well, I think the original start of the book was about 4 years ago. I got a very strange email, and it said, "You don't know me, but I'm your eighth cousin." And I figured, all right, he's going to ask me to wire $10,000 to his Nigerian bank account. But it turns out he was legitimate, and he is one of these people who's obsessed with genealogy, and he's actually helping to build the biggest family tree in history. Millions of people from dozens of countries all connected on the same tree. And that just blew my mind, because I had always thought that genealogy, it seemed a little stodgy, perhaps, a little like a needlepoint. No offense to needlepoint. Yeah. But nowadays, I found out it is one of the most exciting and thrilling areas, and it is it affects every part of our lives, from happiness to politics to race relations to what we teach our kids. And so I was hooked.
Part of what you said that moved you by the idea in the email is that this could give us a sense of belonging. Give us an idea of what that sense of belonging you think could do for us.
You know, our parents always told us that the world was one big family. Everyone was one part of the human family. But I kind of forgot that. And now, thanks to science and genealogy, you can actually see this in a very concrete way. You can see how you're linked through DNA to everyone else on Earth. And to me, it really does shift my perspective, and it makes me just a little less tribal, a little less us and them and realize there is only us. Now, I'm not perfect. I'm as petty as most people are born petty, but I'm fighting it. I'm really fighting it. And let me give you an example. It may sound a little trivial, but Judge Judy, the TV personality.
Yeah.
I always found her incredibly offensive. But then I discovered she is my ninth cousin, and it made me shift my perspective. I said, you know what? She's probably not so bad. She's just doing her shtick, and she's probably a sweetheart underneath. And it shifted my perspective, and I tried to give her the benefit of the doubt. So I'm trying to apply that Judge Judy effect to everyone, and there is some evidence that this might work. There was a great study, a Harvard study just last year, where they told Palestinians and Israelis how closely they were related, and they treated each other with more kindness and were more open to negotiation.
So I want to ask you about the challenge of getting to that point. One of the people that you interviewed or wanted to interview was Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Right.
He's a distant cousin. Everyone's a distant cousin, as we'll
exactly.
sort of talk about. But he has this philosophy. So you said, talk to me about this. And he sent you an email where he conveyed this philosophy that must have made you kind of disappointed. And basically, here's how he put it in the email. He said, I just don't care about family history. And this is... He sort of puts a finer point on it. And that's not a passive, but an active absence of caring. What did he mean? Why doesn't he and others, and you've felt this, you sort of relate to it on some level, why didn't he care? Why doesn't he care?
Well, it's interesting. I actually loved that email
yeah.
and found it inspiring in a weird way. Because his argument is that family is actually quite tribal. And he's saying, why should I care more about someone just because they're my first cousin than I do about some stranger in Borneo? Mm-hmm. That we should try to be inspired by anyone who is in the human family, whether that's Gandhi or Albert Einstein. And I love this because part of my purpose in this book was to show just that.
Yeah.
We are all one big family, and that's the way we've got to start thinking about the world. So I argued to him, I was like, that's my point,
yeah.
is that
yeah.
I consider Albert Einstein part of the family, so he can be inspiring. But I also made the point that I love traditional genealogy as well,
mm-hmm.
where you just research your great-great-grandparents and find out what they were doing, and you know, did they fight in the Civil War? Did they, because to me, that's a way of connecting with history. It's just a nice inroad into realizing what life was like and how grateful we should be about all the amazing sacrifices that these people made. Because the good old days were not good;
yeah.
they were terrible.
Yeah.
And so that gives me a lot of gratitude and inspiration.
So you don't make a distinction between because one of the things you say is that whether it's narcissism or just a lack of imagination, you yourself are drawn to your own specific line of ancestors. But you're saying that's okay, that this is a kind of common trait. It's a deep-seated part of human nature that, yes, we're all technically part of a global family, but we're also particularly interested in that one specific line and all the great inspiring figures and maybe even the kind of dodgy figures. You're saying that's okay?
Absolutely. I do think that. And yeah, you can't get around it. You are more interested in the people who helped create you. And I think that's okay. And it's interesting you mentioned the great and the dodgy, because that was one of the actually, I learned this from many people in Salt Lake City like to bring it up, that there's a great study that showed that teaching your kids genealogy is correlated to their happiness and,
yeah.
and being well-adjusted. But it's not just memorizing dates. It's telling the stories of how they struggled, how they went up, how they went down, how maybe one was went bankrupt, another one became a successful doctor. And you've got to tell that to your kids so that they get this resilience. They realize that it's not going to be easy sailing.
Yeah. I also like the part where you write about how, you know, you found a few stains in your family tree and you ask, so what's the appropriate feeling? Like, how much guilt should I, you know, inherit for the sins of my ancestors? And your takeaway from that part of the book, which I found really great, is that you focus on gratitude, not guilt.
That is really one of the big takeaways of the book. Yeah. And I feel that about all of my ancestors. Just reading about, for instance, I knew my grandfather did not grow up with a lot of money. But the fact that interviewing my aunt, I found out the details. He during the Depression, had to sell pretzels on the street corner. It was like something out of fiction. He got arrested and thrown in jail at the age of 13 for selling pretzels. And that boggles my mind because I am lucky enough to live in New York, and I have enough to eat. And I try to remind my kids that I think they're getting a little annoyed by me telling them exactly how lucky they are. But hopefully it's sinking in.
For all the lifestyle experiments that you've done in the course of your career, I was surprised to see you say in the book that this has been the most exhilarating experience of your life.
Well, I think in a sense it was, because I've done a lot of experiments I found fascinating, sometimes painful, but always interesting.
Yeah.
But a lot of them had to do with changing myself. And focusing on myself. So I did one where I was on your program a few years ago talking about living by all the rules of the Bible.
Yeah.
So the Ten Commandments, but also not shaving my beard and not wearing clothes of mixed fibers, stoning adulterers, but I used very small stones like
at Central Park.
So no one got,
yeah, right.
That's right. You remember.
I do.
But that one had a lot to do with changing, trying to make me a better ethical person. This one was interesting because it didn't just involve me. It involved 7 billion people. And I had to reach out to all these people and try to get them to come to my big event, mm-hmm. which was the Global Family Reunion. And I spent – so it was a much more external project. And as you know, I spent a lot of time in Salt Lake City, so I got to meet – a lot of the people there who were doing amazing things for genealogy. And I will say, I threw this event, and we can get into it later.
Yeah,
but
we will.
All right, well, I'll save it. But you, the Salt Lake City event that happened simultaneously is was so much better organized than my event because, I mean, and it was mostly done by the people in the Family Search and Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I mean, they are the greatest organizers in the history of
Mormons
the world.
Are the best organizers ever. There is no
doubt unbelievable.
About it. Yeah, it's
I
true.
Know.
Yeah.
I was so jealous.
Yeah.
Which I know is
right,
not a biblical. It's not a biblical emotion.
Okay, so one of the things. So as you are thinking about this idea of creating this big global family reunion, you went through some of the pros and cons. I wanted to ask you about one of the pros that you list. One of the pros is...
By the way, thank you for reading the book.
Oh.
I love that you are, and I've listened to you, so I know you do, but you should know, as you probably do, not always the case when you're interviewed on the radio.
Well, thanks. It was fun to read. So one of the pros was this. You wrote... I could stretch the idea of family to its breaking point, that basically you were hoping to, on some level, deconstruct family. Now, this is an important theme in the book, your sense of what family is or what it should be or what it shouldn't be. Talk to me a little bit about this.
Right. Well, family is a complicated notion because there are some philosophers I talk to who say it's actually an unfair way to organize society because you are going to favor your immediate family over the good of society. And it could be something like, you know, if your kid has lice and he's not supposed to go to school technically, but he's got a big exam that day, and it would really mess him up if he didn't. So you kind of like, all right, we'll go and we won't tell anyone. We'll hope for the best. That is a very human emotion, but it's not great for society at large. So there are some people who say we should try to get rid of family. And they did this like in Soviet Russia. They said the state is your family. You should pay less attention. You should report your parents if they're doing something wrong. And there's terrible stories of kids doing that. So on some very rational level, family is not great. But on the other hand, it's so deeply ingrained. There's no way I'm not going to love my kids more than a stranger on the street. So we have to figure out how best to take advantage of this without forgetting about the rest of the society and just focusing on our kids. So that was sort of the motivation. And the way I did it was try to picture the family as bigger and bigger and bigger, and thanks to these amazing tools, you can actually do that. You can see how you're related, however crazily distantly, to almost anyone on Earth through Family Search and Genie, these websites. For instance, Barack Obama is my fifth great aunt's husband's brother's wife's seventh great nephew. Yeah. So we're practically brothers.
Well, since you mention it, my grandfather, Robert Henry Moon, is your first cousin once removed's wife's fourth great uncle's wife's sister's husband's granddaughter's husband's brother's wife's brother.
I know. I love that. I feel so close. I want you to come over to Passover next year. Come to New York. I feel we're mishpucha, as the Jews say. And that is just one of like 800 ways we're related. Scientists say the farthest cousin you have on Earth, like, you know, a yam farmer in Papua New Guinea is about your 70th cousin, which is not so far off.
No.
So I do love that idea of it's very concrete and real, this world family.
Take us to the kind of origin, the sort of human origin story. I know it's really complicated, but you get at this idea. I mean, you don't believe in a literal Adam and Eve, of course, but this idea of real life Adam and Eve has kind of powerful implications.
It was fascinating. And scientists talk about this. It was about 200,000 years ago, and they call them the Y-chromosomal Adam and mitochondrial Eve. So not quite as exciting as simple as Adam and Eve. But these were the humans who roamed on the plains of Africa and whose descendants led to us. So every single person on Earth, all 7 billion plus, has strands of Adam and Eve's DNA in them. Now, they weren't the first humans. Mm-hmm. Humans had been around for millennia before that. They're just the ones whose DNA happens to survive in us. So there were thousands of wannabe Adams and Eves walking around at the same time. But I just do love that there is an actual person, an actual human, who knows what his name was or her name was, but there are 5,000th great-grandfather. And sometimes I try to imagine, like, what would my 5,000th great-grandfather think if I'm cutting this guy off in traffic? Maybe he'd be disappointed.
A.J. Jacobs is with us. His book is It's All Relative, Adventures Up and Down the World's Family Tree. Next Tuesday night, he's going to be giving a reading at the King's English Bookshop in Salt Lake City. We'll have details about that on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a quick break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about genealogy, tracing your ancestors back, building a family tree, which we do really well here in Utah, as the experimental journalist A.J. Jacobs found out. He came here, of course, when he was writing his new book. He takes a deep dive into genealogy in the book, basically tried to organize the world's largest family reunion. His book is called It's All Relative, Adventures Up and Down the World's Family Trees, coming to Utah next week to give a reading. We'll give you details about that. He's joining us from the studios of the Radio Foundation in New York City. So let's talk about the two revolutions that are going on in genealogy right now. We mentioned DNA a bit. Talk a little bit about the other revolution, the internet family tree revolution, because this thing is huge.
It is huge. It's mind-blowing. And by the way, I just do want to agree with you when you said that you do genealogy really well. I say in the book that Mormons are like the Golden State Warriors of genealogy, you guys. And what I love is the openness that you don't hoard in, that the Mormons don't hoard the information. They let it free for everyone to access. So that's really remarkable, and I thank them for that.
Okay, let me just say my favorite comparison that you made for Mormons and genealogy is you say, like the Brazilians dominate supermodeling, the Mormons dominate genealogy.
Exactly. Yeah. I do believe that Mormons are terrific at genealogy. So thank you for that. Yes, the other revolution, there are several revolutions going on in genealogy. One is these massive family trees, because the model used to be that you would have your family tree of a couple hundred people. You'd put it on the computer or just in paper form. But now it's more of almost it's a Wikipedia version where you are all sharing one big family tree. So it's thousands, even millions of people working on one big jigsaw puzzle at the same time. And so if you put up your family tree on one of these services like Family Search or Genie or Wikitree, and you find that there's an A.J. Jacobs on my tree, but there's also an A.J. Jacobs on someone else's tree. Is it the same A.J. Jacobs? You compare birth dates and marriage, and yes, it is. Then you can merge trees. So you just keep merging and merging and merging until you get this one massive it's not a tree. It's a forest. It's a series of interlocking forests. And it's a fascinating world. There are pros and cons to it.
Yep.
There are some genealogists who think that it's not fact-checked well enough, which is a good point. But it's also quite amazing and revolutionary and has many, many benefits that allow you to find relatives you had no idea you were
you were related to. Yeah.
Right.
Sorry, cut you off there.
I didn't want to repeat the word relatives you're related to. So, yeah.
Well, I feel like since we're related, I'm just finishing your sentences. So
there you go.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So when you do they have a type? The people who dig into genealogy, when you came here, for example, to Salt Lake, we're here for this family history conference in Salt Lake. Is there a type? Are they all the same? Do they have common characteristics, or are they all over the place?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I do remember one genealogist telling me that there was a unusually high proportion of Hawaiian shirts in among genealogists. So I don't know what that means. But I would say the type is just curiosity and engagement, especially in history and other humans. So this idea that history is fascinating and learning about what our ancestors' lives were like is illuminating to your own life. I will say there might be an interesting split in genealogy because traditionally, at least, you know, decades ago, it could be seen as a very exclusive hobby because it's like, you know, I'm directly descended from the Mayflower passengers and you're not. Therefore, you cannot join my golf club.
Right.
So there was a bit of an elitist strain. Nowadays, I see more of an inclusive strain, this idea of, you know what, we're all can somehow link to these great people in the past and also these not-so-great people. And I actually spent a good amount of time with the Daughters of the American Revolution. Mm-hmm. And it was fascinating because even them, who can be seen as the prototypically elitist club, are trying to open their gates a little more. And the woman I spent time with, she's one of the heads of the New York chapter, and she is African-American, which was very interesting because it's not considered traditionally an African-American organization. In fact, they got in trouble, as they should have, in the 1930s for banning Marian Anderson from singing at one of their events because she was African American. But now they're trying to be inclusive, and this woman says her goal is to show the American Revolution was the First World War. You had African Americans, you know, Native Americans in the war, French, German, Latinos. So I love that idea.
You're right. So there's this give and take, as you say, in all of this. You mentioned exclusivity versus inclusivity. You also write about science versus eugenics. And you say, I wanted you to maybe talk a little bit about this, how it's kind of sobering and maybe more than a little depressing to realize that genealogy has had this history of being co-opted by horrible racists, too.
Oh, yeah. Well, genealogy is a tool, and like any tool, I think it can be used for good or evil. And unfortunately, in the past, it has sometimes, not always, been used for evil. But Nazis are an obvious case. They used genealogists to study the so-called purity of people's blood and try to root out people who were part Jewish. So, yeah, absolutely, it can be terrible. It'll be very interesting in this day and age of DNA because the results are showing more and more how mixed people are and how racial purity is a myth. Yeah. And there's some fascinating stories of white supremacists who get their results back from 23andMe, your ancestry, and they flip out because it shows they're part Jewish or part African-American. They accuse the companies of having a multicultural agenda and that this is all a conspiracy. So it will be fascinating. I have hope that DNA will make it more inclusive, that we'll realize we are all mutts. We're all a mix. There is an alternative scenario, a more dystopian scenario. One professor told me, he's a sociologist, and he fears that people will link their DNA results to a dating app like Tinder, and you'll only hook up with people who are of very similar DNA. So it could go either way. I'm hopeful that it'll go the good way because I have faith in humanity. Yeah. My cousins, I think my cousins will make the right choice, but it's always a danger.
Well, your cousin, the comedian Kumail Nanjiani, he has a more pessimistic view. You quote him here in the book. Here's his assessment of the internet. Hope: internet will allow people from different backgrounds to communicate and understand one another. Reality: all the racists found each other.
I think that is a brilliant assessment. But I also think in the long term, the first one is going to win out. I really do believe that. We've got these horrible pockets, these bubbles where people just read, go on their alt-right websites or radical and confirm their own biases. But I do believe in the power of information, and sunlight is the best disinfectant, and eventually people will realize how close that we share 99.9% of our DNA, and it's just crazy to stress the tribal nature, the separateness. People have become weirdly obsessed with breaking into these little groups and seeing the other as the enemy.
Here's one more aspect where you examine the healthy and not so healthy perspectives that come from genealogy: narcissism versus humility. During this process, you had this realization, and it was pointed out by a really honest friend who said
a great
that
genealogist.
He said so you have this project of trying to unite the world, but somehow you've managed to make yourself the center of it. I like it. This is pretty typical of your writing. You're constantly checking yourself. But would you just talk about a little bit about this part? Because you say, on one hand, this can be genealogy, the most self-aggrandizing hobby ever.
Well, that is a danger, is that when you in one way of looking at genealogy, it's like, okay, you had two parents, you had four grandparents, and it doubles. So you go back 10 generations. There were hundreds of thousands of people who had to get together, who had to hook up just to create you. So it's like, oh, my God, everything happened just to create me. I am the center of the universe.
Yeah.
But you can flip that on your head and realize you go back 10 generations and take a look at your 10th great-grandfather, who was a goat farmer in Iberia, and realize how many hundreds of thousands of descendants he had, and that you really are not all that special. So I actually like a combination of those, that you are special, that it is a miracle that we exist, but we've got to remember we are just a drop in the ocean and that there are all these other people as well.
Seems like all of us have that one person in the family. Now, some may have more, and in Utah, there may be a lot, but it seems like in our family, it was Uncle Raymond, who's constantly digging into the genealogy and working this stuff out. Did you have someone like that? Was that your grandmother, Ann Keel?
Well, yes, my grandmother. I was very lucky because she was one of the great archivists of our time. I mean, she kept every scrap of information. So I was so lucky with this book to be able to access, my great-great-grandfather's 60th anniversary party had a program, and I have it, and I can read the toasts,
yeah.
And they are funny and bizarre, and I can and every little newspaper clipping, so I feel very lucky. And luckily also, I actually don't think this is like, I think everyone's got fascinating relatives, but my relatives, I found, my grandfather, I knew he was involved in the civil rights movement, but I didn't know how deeply enmeshed he was. I got his FBI file, and it was hundreds of pages long because he was one of Martin Luther King Jr.'s lawyers, and he actually threw fundraisers for Martin Luther King. So I've got all this FBI information, and the amount of detail is both impressive and terrifying. You know, they knew what his favorite restaurants were, where his daughters lit, what dorms they were in college, how he romanced my grandmother at college, how he broke into the infirmary while she was sick with the flu and got in trouble. So it was really, remarkable what's available. And yeah, I do think that my grandmother was I'm very lucky to have her.
You know, it raises one of the questions that comes up in the book, and that is, do we have more privacy now than our ancestors had? Because you sort of come to the conclusion privacy didn't mean as much in the old days, and things are different now. And so how much of the idea of privacy should we apply to these searches? I mean, your mother was... She thinks we're going too far, it seems like, in some ways.
Right. My mother was a little nervous about, and I had mixed feelings, too. I mean, there's this one relative I had who I think is my second great uncle. And the only information I could find of him, the only record, was that he was quoted in a 1903 newspaper advertisement for hemorrhoid cream. So he was endorsing this hemorrhoid cream, and I'm like, oh man, that's his legacy. That's what people are going to...
Yeah.
And unfortunately, I wrote about it in my book, so I certainly didn't help the cause.
Yeah.
So I'm sorry, Uncle Leo. But it is interesting to think, dude, that I think overall the world is better when we know more and when we know more about our ancestors and realize they had their faults, but they also had their heroic qualities. So I am pro digging into my ancestors' lives. Not too deep. You know, you don't want to expose everything. But
you never know who was cleaning up what, though. Didn't your grandmother kind of clean up the family tree a little bit, or at least leave out people that maybe she didn't think were.
Oh yeah,
yeah, yeah.
There was a tremendous amount of whitewashing going on, and she would leave people out that she didn't like. She would. One of my relatives was married to the sister of a noted violinist, and they were married for 4 days or something like that.
Yeah.
But somehow that woman makes it on because she's related to a violinist. So yeah, it is interesting to see. Genealogy is not. It really shows our biases. I mean, just think of the people we focus on. You have so many thousands of great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandparents, but people always talk about, oh, that was my ancestor was the captain of a whaling ship, or my ancestor was, in the court of King Henry VIII. They never say my ancestor, worked in the outhouses at, my ancestor was an embezzler and a horse thief. So it's a very biased view. And I like to try to balance that. I do like, as I said earlier, I think showing the good and the bad is important, and which is why I found it so bizarre and wrongheaded when Ben Affleck tried to suppress the fact that one of his ancestors was a slave owner.
Yeah.
He was on that show,
yeah.
Finding Your Roots, and he refused to acknowledge it. He tried to get it crushed. But I thought it was such a missed opportunity because he obviously is not racist, and he is it can show you can overcome your ancestors. You are not beholden to their sins. And I think that's an important lesson, but I think he blew it in that case.
A.J. Jacobs is with us. His book is It's All Relative, Adventures Up and Down the World's Family Tree. He's coming to Utah next week on Tuesday. He's going to be at the King's English Bookshop in Salt Lake City for a reading there. We have details about it on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
Why aren't you on Twitter?
Because I'm terrible at Twitter. Sometimes our reporters can sound just a little stiff on air.
Do you not think it's real life?
No, I don't think I do.
Oh.
But like you just heard, Julia Ritchie, she's kind of funny. This is Doug Fabrizio, by the way. You can hear our conversation about Twitter and politics on our new podcast. It's called More to Say. You can download it November 16th, wherever you get your podcast. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. A.J. Jacobs is with us. We're talking about his new book, another experiment. The book is called It's All Relative, Adventures Up and Down the World's Family Tree. He is basically trying to put together the world's largest family reunion and kind of pulls it off. We'll get back to that here in a moment. He's joining us from a studio in New York City. So the chapter where you come here to Utah, you titled The Pilgrimage. So this family history conference in Salt Lake City, which we've talked a little bit about, it's a huge thing. You describe it as the world's quietest rave.
Right. Well, that's when they open the family history library until late. And so it's, people in the library until midnight, I thought was a reminded me of the world's quietest rave. But you're right. This Roots Tech conference is astounding. It is, I think last year, at least 25,000 people. They seem to go up every year. Mm. And I was a keynote speaker at the Roots Tech conference. And it was, first of all, the largest group I had ever spoken to. It was 8,000 people. Mm. And I'm used to speaking to groups of, 100. So it was, I didn't know how to handle that. And then the other interesting was I was paired with Donny Osmond.
Yeah.
So I was the warm-up guy
right.
for Donny Osmond, which in a predominantly Mormon crowd, that is a tough a tough act to precede.
To precede, yeah.
But they were so supportive and lovely. And they actually, I got to sing with the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, which was quite an honor. I didn't sing in the real, they were smart enough to put me in a rehearsal so that no one was
hurt.
Was subjected.
But it's still, that's the thing, right? It's a pretty amazing choir.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and it also, I mean, a lot of this book is about being part of a community.
Totally.
And human connection, and you can't really get much more connected than people singing in harmony together as sort of the ultimate platonic ideal of being in a community.
But you are, and I want to mention this, you were pretty honest about your trepidation about coming here. I mean, feeling as a secular Jew who is on record as being pro-gay marriage, finding,
right,
as you say, the LDS Church's position on that, here's how you put it, deeply troubling. And you also mentioned how your project on some level fits perfectly with the goals of the LDS Church's ideas with genealogy. But on the other hand, your thesis, you say, is totally at odds with the Mormons. I mean, you are trying to embrace all kinds of family structures, and you don't really like the idea, or you're trying to de-emphasize anyway the idea of the quote-unquote traditional family.
Right.
Do you want to say something about that?
Yeah. I mean, it is an interesting attention. As you say, in some ways, it's I meshed perfectly because the head of Family Search talked about my project and how when someone cuts you off on the highway, you've got to remember we're all one big family. So in some ways, we were totally in sync. On the other hand, as you mentioned, I am, you know, I'm a liberal New York Jew, so I'm in favor of gay marriage or legalizing gay marriage and also expanding the definition of family to be all sorts of different configurations. And I actually, one of the more interesting lessons I learned is not to stereotype and not to think that Mormonism is a monolith. I found plenty of Mormons who were very active in trying to be accepting of gay Mormons. I talked to one of the most fascinating stories to me in the book is a Mormon man who came from a family with 9 siblings. And it turned out they thought they were all from the same biological father. It turned out they had 9 different fathers.
Yeah.
None of them were from that one father. And it was an amazing story on so many levels. First, the fact that the father was treated these kids as if they were his own biological offspring is so inspiring. The forgiveness of many of the kids towards their mother. But one of the things this guy said, and he's a faithful member of the Mormon Church, is that there is no such thing as a traditional family, that everyone's got a twist on it. And as long as there's a level of love and trust and some discipline, that's okay. You know, we don't have to have everyone in the exact same formation. You can have uncles and aunts and adopted cousins, as long as there is a level of love.
What it was interesting, you asked Donny Osmond what the secret to a great marriage was. You asked the same of President Bush, George Bush Sr., whom you met in the process of writing the book. Do you always ask people that who have long marriages?
You know, I should start to.
Yeah.
I did it mostly because of the project. I wanted to dive into family as much as possible. And I did love Mrs. Bush's comment about how she tries to – it's all about not taking your spouse for granted. Instead, treating them almost like a friend or a house guest. So going the extra mile, if you both put in 75%, then there's a lot better chance the marriage will work because we overestimate how much we do. So 75% is probably at most 50%.
Yeah.
So trying to overestimate, I mean, overcompensate for what you're doing.
I loved this. I have to say I wrote this down because I want to remember it. The George Bush Sr., President Bush, told you the best advice that had been given to him by his mom. And it was basically give the other guy credit, which is
nice. Yeah. Which I love. And that has been a theme. I actually just gave a talk at my book party last night. And my theme was, it's so strange that this book has just one name on the cover, because there should be hundreds. There are all these people who contributed to it, the editors, the designers, the salespeople, and all the people who told me the wisdom that made this book possible. So I think books are a very strange, and many things are very lopsided in how they give credit to one person as opposed to making it a team. Mm-hmm. And I think that goes along with the theme of my book, we're all a team. We're all in this together.
So it turns out this idea of there being only 6 degrees of separation, which you hear about all the time, is a thing. And in fact, there maybe are even fewer degrees that connect us. Would you say something about that?
Sure. The 6 degrees of separation was an actual study done by a Yale professor, where he gave letters to random people in the United States and tried to have them send it to other randomly chosen people, and it took on average about 6 steps of people who knew each other to get to that final destination. But now, with all of these social networks, it's actually shrunk. Facebook did a study where they estimated that it's really 2.5 degrees, and I believe that. I think that part of this book is that family is the ultimate social network. We are all connected because we're all cousins and we all come from the same DNA. So it's really not just this, this silly notion. It's true. We are, whether it's 6 degrees or 2.5 degrees or 10 degrees, we are very closely linked.
There was a woman who approached you after a talk that you write about, and she kind of disagreed with you because she figured you hadn't include animals in the story of the family history. But in fact, you do. I mean, and this is something you write about. Animals are our cousins.
Yes, I love that idea that we are. It's not just the human family, it's the living beings family, and that we all do come from, our original ancestor. I actually showed a picture of him or her at the party last night.
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now in the book.
Yeah, it's very attractive, very a nice looking person. Well, bacterium.
Yep.
And it is this, our 1.2 billionth great-grandparent, which was the first organism to have these strands of DNA. And we all have those strands. They've come down through millions of generations, and everyone on Earth has strands of this bacterium called – it's actually got a name. It's called the last universal common ancestor.
Yeah.
So LUCA. That's what scientists call it, LUCA. I have a son named Lucas, and he was excited that he had the same name as the ultimate ancestor. I love this idea that we are all linked, and it's actually not a new insight. Charles Darwin, in his very first book on evolution, said that all animals are cousins to the millionth degree. And I love that because I do think that we need to adjust our thinking about animals and that they do suffer and that we need to treat them with more kindness.
I don't want to give too much away about the reunion, whether you pulled it off or whether you didn't. I'll sort of leave that to people to read the book. But it was one of the weirdest events in history, you say. And by that you meant, gloriously weird, like in the good way?
Yes, I loved the weirdness of it. But I agree with you. It was bizarre. It was, we just had the strangest – and most diverse collection of people I had ever seen. We had celebrities and scientists. We had a rabbi, a minister, and a Buddhist monk. So it was almost like the setup to a joke, you know. And there, I guess there was a bar there. There was some beer you could buy. And we had historical impersonators, Frisbee champions. And I loved it. And, yeah, I don't want to give it away too much, as you say, but I was – honestly, I was actually miserable during the event because I was so worried and stressed out that something would go wrong and I would be sued for $1 million. I can say that did not happen, thank God.
Yeah.
But people did seem to it did spark some lovely interactions. There was a lot of spontaneous hugging going on. I'm not a hugger myself, but I was happy to see people, strangers, hugging. And as I said, there were 40 simultaneous reunions. So we call them branch parties around the world. And the Salt Lake City one was the second largest of after – it was the largest after the main event in New York City. And if they had had a couple of more months, if they had had as long to plan as I did, I'm sure it would have been double the size of mine.
Well, one thing you mentioned is you had hoped for is that you would end racism in all wars. That didn't that didn't quite happen. But you do say the possibility is that in about a decade or two, we will be able to find a link for all 7 billion of us. What kind of difference do you figure that's going to make?
Well, I do hope it will make a difference. You know, I don't think it's the only thing we need, but it is an important step in the right direction. It's an important reminder that we are all so interconnected. And I also think it's interesting just looking at the trends of marrying between cultures and ethnicities, that that is speeding up more and more quickly. And so this idea of purity of race is just is getting more less and less relevant, and that we're all going to be mixed up. And, you know, the melting pot is becoming a reality. So hopefully that will help with the current situation, because as we discussed, this obsession with separateness and tribalism it's preventing us from getting together and working on the really big problems that we need to address, like pandemic diseases or poverty or weapons of mass destruction or climate change. These are worldwide problems that we need to cooperate on.
And we can solve them as cousins.
It's so true. Over a family dinner, over like Thanksgiving.
A.J. Jacobs, this book is called It's All Relative, Adventures Up and Down the World's Family Tree. He's going to be giving a reading on Tuesday night at the King's English Bookshop in Salt Lake City. You can get details about it on our website, radiowest.org. A.J., thank you very much for coming back and talking to us.
Oh, thank you, Doug. It was great.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. Technical direction from Michael Havey. I'm Doug Fabrizio.